Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on a cruise with public radio listeners. The Obama administration says it needs a reliable partner in Kabul to carry out whatever strategy it embarks on for Afghanistan. The decision by Abdullah Abdullah to withdraw from Saturday's scheduled elections means Hamid Karzai will lead that country. Joining me in the studio to discuss what's next for the people of Afghanistan and how 4 more years of Hamid Karzai might affect President Obama's strategy in that country, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Karen Von Hippel with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Richard Fontaine with the Center for a New American Security. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. Later in this hour, we'll take your calls and questions at 1-800-433-8850, or you can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, David Ignatius, you just got back from Afghanistan yesterday. What was your sense of the reaction to the decision by Abdullah Abdullah to withdraw and then the decision that followed by the Election Commission to cancel Saturday's runoff?
As I left Kabul on Saturday, Susan, it was clear that Abdullah would withdraw. And the reaction among Americans that I talked to was one of relief, primarily, in the sense that I think that they feared that the runoff process could lead to more tumult, more delay. They'd worked hard to get the runoff. Senator Kerry had gone out to negotiate with President Karzai to get him to accept a process that would lead to the runoff, and there was some hope that it might add some legitimacy to Karzai's victory. But there was also a lot of worry that it would be a destabilizing element. So I think what I was hearing was basically, let's get on with the show now, and the beginning of a long process that we're just now seeing the first stages of pressuring Karzai, lobbying Karzai to do something about corruption and governance, which every American in Kabul, I think, would tell you is job one.
Karen Von Hippel, you were supposed to fly out on this Monday, just yesterday, for the runoff election. Of course, you didn't go since there is no runoff election. So tell us, why do you think Abdullah Abdullah decided to pull out?
Well, I was there in August as an observer with the National Democratic Institute. And, you know, we all know about the fraud that was committed during that period. Over 1 million votes were stolen. There were a number of reforms that could have been implemented in between the two or before the second round, but it really wasn't apparent that any of those reforms were going to happen. And so he just thought there's going to be corruption, there's going to be fraud again, and, you know, if they're not going to minimize the fraud, why should I run? I think he also knew that he wouldn't win as well. So he was, you know, he was sort of playing games as well to position himself for his future.
Well, Richard Fontaine, what was the attitude of the U.S. government and other Western powers? Did we want this runoff election to go forward?
Well, in some ways, it's certainly a relief that we don't have to go through a runoff round and try to maintain the security and for those polls and try to deal with potential fraud in yet another round. But at the same time, this brings to the fore the legitimacy issue that so many have made an issue, including among those in the administration who are trying to figure out what the next step should be. And the question on the table is, how do we now get President Karzai and his administration from top all the way down to the bottom to really eliminate some of the corruption and be seen as more legitimate in the eyes of the Afghan people?
Well, what did we hear yesterday from President Obama? He made a sort of congratulatory phone call to Hamid Karzai.
It was fascinating, Susan. President Obama, as soon as the Independent Election Commission in Afghanistan had certified that Karzai would be the president absent this runoff, President Obama called to congratulate him and said, now is the time for decisive efforts against corruption to begin. We will judge President Karzai by his deeds. Essentially said, if he doesn't get more serious about corruption, all bets are off in terms of continuing long-term American support. And we saw a statement today by Karzai himself admitting that that his administration had been tainted by corruption, suggesting that he would do some things to reform the situation. Tainted really doesn't capture the degree of corruption. The people who know Afghanistan far better than I, Americans who've lived there for years, speak of this really as almost a criminal enterprise, a country that has billions of dollars at stake in a status quo that's corrupt. So breaking that, really breaking it, is going to be difficult.
Well, should we take Karzai's word with – do Karzai's words to promise to address this issue have any credibility then?
Well, I actually think that we need to have a new partnership with the Afghan government, and I think we need to change our behavior too. We need to admit that we haven't been implementing our aid or even fighting necessarily in the right ways. I mean, Afghanistan is in this situation because of poor governance, but we've also collectively, the international community, have mishandled the situation over the last 8-9 years. And so I do think that both sides need to make a fresh start. I mean, to give you one example, the story that came out recently in the New York Times about the CIA having Ahmad Wali Karzai, his younger brother, who's the chieftain down in the south, on their payroll. Now, whether or not that's true, the perception throughout Afghanistan is that that story is true. I heard that story ages ago. It's not a new story. So if we're pushing the Afghan government to take warlords out of power and we're being perceived as supporting a warlord, it appears very hypocritical to the Afghan people. It's like this nudge, nudge, wink, wink, change your behavior. But they don't really take it very seriously.
Richard Frontaine, do you agree with that, that some of the fault is ours?
I do, particularly on the issue of Ahmad Karzai. Here is someone who is seen as a lightning rod for the corruption problems in Afghanistan. And I don't know whether the CIA has got a relationship with him, but as a strategic communications issue, it's a terrible, terrible message to send that we would be on his side rather than on the side of those who are trying to clamp down on corruption. Another point that I would make along those lines, and something that I think we've done wrong in the past, is the way that aid has been funneled into Afghanistan. One of the things that we should have been trying to do is bolster the local government and tribal and village communities in order for them to deliver aid and thereby bolster the legitimacy of at least local government, district-level government. Instead, what we've done is set up thousands and thousands of AID and international aid contractors who will go in, often with foreigners that are embedded in local areas for this aid delivery. And what this has done is drain some of the brains away who would otherwise be working for the government, and also give a greater sense of legitimacy to those who are delivering the aid internationally rather than the government that we're trying to build some allegiance to among the people.
Yeah, if I could just bolster Richard's point, Susan. 75% of donor money in Afghanistan has gone outside the Afghan government. Now, donors argue they do this because they're worried about corruption, but it's very hard if you're a government, if you're trying to manage a budget, to know, you know, how to even plan for the next few years if you don't even know where most of the money is going. So, you know, I just wanted to reinforce Richard's point.
Well, David, how is this problem? We've been at war in Afghanistan now for 8 years. I think it's the second longest war since our nation was founded, second only to the Vietnam War, and yet we're still struggling over devising strategies that work. Why has that happened?
The comments you hear often in Afghanistan is that we have been fighting a one-year war in Afghanistan 8 years in a row. In other words, we've had short-term strategies that have had a palliative effect at best, and we haven't dug deep and really come to grips with the governance and corruption issues. I think there are two separable issues here. This is a very corrupt state. It is a narco state. People, again, who know Afghanistan well say that while it always had a degree of corruption, there was a kind of hyper-corruption that developed after the Soviets withdrew in 1989, and a new class of extremely rich, well-armed, kind of, 21st century warlords emerged. They, among other things, they broke up the tribal structure, which had been part of how the country stayed together. So very corrupt people, billions of dollars at stake. Then there's a second problem that in some ways is even more complicated, and that's just the reality of building governance at the local district, provincial levels. And these institutions are fragile, in some cases non-existent. Everywhere I went last week, I saw Americans working with provincial and district officials, and I put that in invisible quotations, trying to build up local governance, because I think there's a recognition that Kabul's going to remain a long way off. The capital in Kabul and national institutions are going to remain remote, but maybe the U.S. can help build local institutions and you have a more of a bottom-up process. That's the hope, at least.
I wonder, do you think that Abdullah will join forces with Hamid Karzai, either now or at some point, to kind of bolster the legitimacy of that government? Karen, what do you think?
Well, I think he will certainly try to get some of his folks into government positions. He has been pressuring for decentralization of power. He would like some changes in the constitution. Everybody is appointed by Karzai right now, the ministers, the governors. It's a very fragmented society, so the constitutional design doesn't exactly match the current setup in the country. But that would be a long process to make changes in the constitution.
Richard, the thing that we keep hearing from the administration, from President Obama and Vice President Biden and the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, is that we need a reliable partner in Afghanistan. Is Karzai now seen as that reliable partner we can depend upon?
Well, there's certainly many, many doubts after the election. But I'd also point out that Karzai is not the only partner that we have in Afghanistan, not the only partner we have in the Afghan government. There are ministers and people in ministries that are better than the leadership of the government may suggest as partners. And there's also, I think, a need to work increasingly at the local, district, and provincial levels, even in sort of block grants that are handed down from Kabul, in order to do this. So it's not just a question of whether Karzai has now sort of dealt himself out of a legitimacy game and therefore we have no options in Afghanistan left.
Richard Fontaine is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and he was previously a foreign policy advisor to Senator John McCain. And we're also joined this hour by Karen von Hippel, co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project and senior fellow with the International Security Program at CSIS, and our friend David Ignatius from The Washington Post. We'll take a short break. We'll be back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And we're talking this hour about what's happening in Afghanistan and the implications for U.S. policy. With me in the studio, David Ignatius of The Washington Post. He's co-moderator of Post Global on WashingtonPost.com. And Richard Fontaine of the Center for New American Security. Karen von Hippel with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. In just a few minutes, we'll go to the phones. We'll take some of your calls. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. Well, we know that President Obama has been quite seriously considering what to do next in Afghanistan, considering a request for more troops from his commander there. David Ignatius, we originally thought this decision would come in October. It hasn't yet. Now some thought perhaps it will come before the president leaves on a trip to Asia next week. What's your sense of how close he is to making a decision on how to proceed in Afghanistan?
Well, I thought he was getting close several weeks ago. I've written that this is a decision that's so important to President Obama, he's going to make it twice. He made it really back in March when, after considerable study and having a task force to study other task forces, he announced a policy that combined two objectives to stop al-Qaeda, prevent al-Qaeda from getting safe havens, and to reverse the Taliban's gains, much more complicated second goal. I think the president genuinely doesn't know yet what to do. I think he feels this is probably the most consequential choice of his presidency. I think he's haunted by what happened to Presidents Kennedy and Johnson as they slipped toward ever greater involvement in Vietnam without understanding the stakes and also without understanding the corruption, the difficulties with the South Vietnamese government. The parallels are really troubling. So I really think he's gotten accustomed now to taking his time. They've told the military, you know, shut up. They don't want a lot of noise from the military abdicating their strategy until they finish this process. And I think the military is going to accede and give them the time they want.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Vietnam because we've gotten a series of emails from listeners who are making that very point, comparing the situation to Vietnam. Karen, do you think that's a fair one to make? And if it is, what are the lessons you learn from seeing parallels with Vietnam?
Well, you know, it's an interesting point. The Washington Post a few weekends back did a full-page spread on how people compared every international engagement to Vietnam. So Kosovo, Bosnia, Somalia, and they outlined quotes from a number of senators and congressmen and women. You know, of course, you have to take lessons from past operations, but every new intervention is different, and every new intervention is far more lethal than the last one. So, you know, we weren't facing the type of IED suicide attacks, those types of threats and challenges in to the same degree, I think, in a number of the other operations in the 90s, at least, than that we are today in Afghanistan.
David said that the White House would like the generals to be a little quieter than they've been, but it's pretty clear that General McChrystal has asked for 40,000 or even more additional troops there. And I wonder, Richard, does that put the president in a situation where it's almost impossible for him to say no more troops to this commander who he installed in Afghanistan?
Well, I think it makes it difficult for him to say no more troops simply because then it would be incumbent on him to defend the number that's there now, which is around 68,000 Americans, and why that's the magic number for Afghanistan, particularly given that General McChrystal in his assessment said that in the absence of additional troops on the ground, it'd be almost impossible to achieve success in Afghanistan. So both for political reasons and for policy reasons, I think it's very difficult. But if you read, you know, the accounts that are coming out of the discussions, it sounds like what's on the table is some sort of middle course. In addition to General McChrystal's request for 40 or 44,000 additional troops, something on, you know, 20,000 or somewhere in that neighborhood that would do some counterinsurgency, but some, you know, more narrowly tailored counterterrorism operations out in the countryside.
And just explain very briefly the difference between those two approaches, counterterrorism and counterinsurgency.
Well, this has been set up as something of a binary choice between counterterrorism, which would essentially be a strategy of going after bad guys, hunting them down, trying to kill them or capture them through special operations forces, drone strikes, that sort of thing, or counterinsurgency, which is a different strategy that focuses our efforts on protecting the population through security and through building local governance and the delivery of services, the sort of clear, hold, build model that has gotten so much resonance. The reality of the situation is that what General McChrystal has suggested is something that combines both of those in the field. It's both counterinsurgency among the population centers and counterterrorism as an adjunct to that to go after some of the leadership of the insurgent elements.
David?
Yes, I wanted to agree with Richard. I think to some extent this sharply polarized debate between broad counterinsurgency, population-centric, you sit and drink tea with the villagers, and kinetic, as they say, that means, you know, hard-nosed military action, counterterrorism, that whacks insurgents, al-Qaeda figures when they stick their necks up. To juxtapose those is false. Both are parts of the strategy that we're pursuing now. That's one thing you see really clearly when you travel with the military, as I did last week. And under the strategy, any version that I've heard of the strategy going forward, both will be present. The question is, can you achieve either mission effectively with the number of troops that you have? You do get a sense in different parts of Afghanistan where we've added some troops. The Helmand River Valley is an example, Kandahar, where there's a striker brigade, that those additional troops have created pockets of greater security. I mean, you hear that from Afghans that you talk to. They're, you know, with Americans, so you have to discount that a little bit. But, you know, just to the north, just to the west, just to the south, you find continuing instability. And my takeaway from this was where we're at right now probably isn't viable. I mean, you either need to push ahead a little bit more, and what the number of troops for that is, I don't know, or you have to pull back a little bit in terms of your strategy. But where we are, is unsteady.
Yeah. No, also, I mean, I know you probably don't like us always agreeing, but I think a comprehensive counterterrorism strategy would include counterinsurgency. And the reality is that the country has different needs. The North and the West and parts of the center are generally more stable, although parts of it are becoming worse, and the South and the East are far more dangerous. But, you know, the other problem I think we have is we're at the moment we have an incentive structure that we're rewarding bad behavior. So if you're doing well, or you just need money up in the north, and it's kind of quiet there, you don't get any money. But if the Taliban come in and kill people at night and destroy the place, you do get money. So if I was a smart poor northerner, I might maybe invite some people in to start destroying things so I can get some more international attention.
David said that the current situation is probably not sustainable. We need more troops, or we need to pull back some. What do you think? What is the right course for the United States?
Well, I'm not a military strategist. At the moment, I would like to support, I would support McChrystal's request. I think he can play around with some of the numbers, too. He could probably squeeze an extra 10,000 troops out of his current configuration. I mean, he can move around 10,000 non-trigger pullers and maybe contract those out even to Afghans. I mean, that would be an ideal situation, and bring in more troops without increasing the overall number. But, you know, I don't do those types of calculations.
And Richard, what do you think? Would you send more troops? Do you think that's the right thing to do or not?
Yes, I think General McChrystal has it right. You know, they do on the ground, the commanders and who know the math and have looked at past counterinsurgencies, they do what they call a troop-to-task ratio. They try to figure out what exactly are we asking these troops to do and how many troops is it going to take to do it. And they do a series of fairly sophisticated calculations. So in order to second-guess that, I think you have to have some fidelity for your own proposal. And what General McChrystal has done is, try to assess the level of risk that he would have in Afghanistan with an additional, say, 40 or 40,000 troops. One thing that's interesting to note is that in Iraq, at the peak, we had, if you added American troops plus Iraqi security forces, you had about 23 or so security forces per 1,000 population. If you look at the counterinsurgency manuals, they tend to say about 20 per 1,000 population. In Afghanistan right now, that number is about 8 or 9. So we're well below what the sort of prevailing doctrine is for these things. And so I think it argues for us not adding just enough troops, for example, to lose at high cost in Afghanistan.
David.
Just to throw out one note of skepticism, because we are kind of agreeing. I worry that if McChrystal's request and strategy are successful, that there's a danger of mission creep. Right now, his strategy is to protect major population centers. That means Kabul. That means the Helmand River Valley. That means the Kandahar Valley. It means the RC East area, moving east to Jalalabad and north to Assadabad. Okay, so suppose that works, and those areas are stable. But you've still got other areas where we've pulled out our troops that are the new safe havens for the Taliban and the new bases from which they strike us. So surely, at some point, somebody says, it's great to have the Helmand River Valley safe, but now we're getting whacked from some other place. And then you're going to say, Mr. President, just another, 30,000 troops, and we'll be able to go after these new sanctuaries. So that there may be a slippery slope here. And that's why I think it's really important. I'm sure that the president is quizzing his military advisors. Do you really mean that this is it, that you won't come back to me again in a year and say, Mr. President, we to finish the job now, we need another X?
And there's no assurance that that they wouldn't come back in a year.
Well, no, and that's what happened everything. In Vietnam. I mean, military officers kept coming to the president saying, Mr. President, saying to LBJ, Mr. President, another 100,000 and we got this thing licked. And that's what took us down the road that we know was so painful.
Karen?
It's also the case that it's not just American troops that are out there. We have ISAF troops, about 30 to 40,000 of them, and some are allowed to fight and some aren't allowed to fight. And so that configuration also needs to be shaped up as well. And I think some of the NATO troops are committed to changing the way that they fight out there, but others may not be able to as well.
Let's go to the phones and invite some of our listeners to join our conversation. We'll go first to Mordecai. He's calling us from Kendall, Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Excellent, honest dialogue. Thank you, Karen, David, and Richard. Only maybe you won't agree on this point. Could you go back to 9/11, the pretext for the U.S. aggression in Afghanistan, and explain to me how Afghans were responsible for the explosions that pulverized those 110-story skyscrapers in 10 seconds, plus Building 7, no plane alleged to have even hit that. Where was the plane debris at the Pentagon? How can you keep up this big lie for this U.S. aggression? Thank you so much.
All right, Mordecai, thanks for your question. David Ignatius.
Well, that's really going back to first principles, first issues, and maybe outside the scope of our discussion. To me, the evidence that the attacks were planned by al-Qaeda in the safe havens in Afghanistan, carried out systematically as reconstructed by the investigation here, that evidence is pretty overwhelming. I know some people doubt it. I'm not one of them.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850, or you can send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Let's go to Chevy Chase, Maryland, and talk to Manuel. Manuel, you're on the air.
Thank you for this very interesting discussion. Look, I lived in Afghanistan for several years and worked there 40 years ago. Corruption was an old problem there. Corruption exists all over the world, even right here in our dear country. I wonder, I've heard a lot of talk about corruption, but I wonder if your guests could give some descriptions of the kind of corruption that they're talking about.
All right, Manuel, what period of time were you living in Afghanistan yourself?
I was there in 1969 to 71.
All right, well, thanks very much for your call. What when you talk about corruption, what kind of corruption, Richard Fontaine, are you referring to?
Well, there's corruption in Afghanistan, really from the top to the bottom, and so it's everything from paying off police officers in order to not get arrested or to arrest somebody down the street who you might happen to have a personal feud with, all the way to the top with the bribing of judicial officials and you know, people in ministries on the take. But one thing that the caller gets at is I don't think that anyone believes that we can do anything or even necessarily should try to do anything to make Afghanistan a corruption-free environment. There are plenty of countries around the world that have corruption. The question is the degree of corruption and whether it's passed in Afghanistan from corruption that is just sort of a way of doing business in a place like that to a force that makes us unable to really achieve the kinds of basic functions of governance that you would expect to have in a country like that.
You've all been in many places around the world. Is this the, rank it, is it the most corrupt place you've been in the world, or in the top 10, or kind of the middle rank? Where would you place it for Americans when you look at corrupt governments around the world?
When I think of places that I've traveled often, Lebanon, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, I don't think Afghanistan is significantly worse. I will say that what seems to be so debilitating for Afghanistan is that it has become ever more corrupt during the time that we've been involved. We speak about inflation, and inflation is a fact of life everywhere. But there's another process we call hyperinflation, where it gets out of control. It becomes almost impossible to conduct ordinary life when hyperinflation hits. And I've heard people describe the situation in Afghanistan now as hyper-corruption. We've got, you know, narco-traffickers, syndicates that have got billions of dollars at stake. We have the kind of corruption that Richard was referring to, bribes at every level. We've got, you know, at the four customs gates into Afghanistan, we have private rackets, in effect, charging private tariffs for everything that comes into the country. That gets you into the hyper-corruption era, I think.
We have an email from Atticus writing us from here in Washington, D.C. He says, it seems to me we should send an army of accountants to Afghanistan to reduce corruption. What do you think, Karen?
There's certainly things you could do to reduce corruption, and some of those things are already being done. For example, the Aga Khan Development Network in the north is training local villagers on how to read budgets. They call them social audits. And so you have a villager who may not even be able to read and write and says, Why are you spending so much money on cement? Well, it's the best quality we could find. Okay. Why are you spending $500 on a hotel in Kabul? Oh, geez, maybe we, you know, some simple transparency, publishing what we spend and publishing what they spend. The U.S. government doesn't publish what we spend on development. We should be doing that, too. This is taxpayer money.
What do we want Karzai to do, Richard, to show that he's serious about addressing corruption to some degree?
Well, the best thing that he could do would be to arrest some high-profile suspected officials who are involved in corruption. So that would send a tremendous message throughout the country that he's gotten serious, that he's really turned on this issue. Beyond that, and more structurally, there are programs like the National Solidarity Program, which basically provides block grants from Kabul down to local levels, and local level officials together with sort of village elders and those sorts of things make the decisions about how to spend those funds. It's been a very effective way of channeling money for development projects, education, and so forth at local levels, and has avoided a lot of the corruption problems that you get when the ministry in Kabul is directing how to spend that money. So increasing the numbers of national programs that they have to agriculture and that kind of thing could do the same thing.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the state of public opinion in Afghanistan and in the United States as President Obama weighs this important decision. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. And by Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
A look at America's love-hate relationship with shopping. Why we crave that little black dress or power tool, and what the things we buy say about our character. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We've been talking about U.S. policy toward Afghanistan. David Ignatius, you're just back from that country. If you talk to the citizens of Afghanistan, what is that, that is number one on their minds?
I think two things. Security first. People say that, either that security is terrible and that, America must do something about it, or security is better. Thank you, America, for coming and, helping you hear both those things. And then second, governance. I think that people know that they're living in a country where the institutions have broken down, and people who were likely to talk to somebody like me understand that this is their, opportunity to try to build institutions, to build a real country. There's some very interesting discussion about the times in Afghanistan's modern history when institutions worked better in the 1950s and 60s. And one thing that people who really have looked at this have, concluded is that at that time there were very decentralized institutions, that the tribal structure was stronger, that, that government didn't all focus around Kabul, big money programs. So there is an attempt by the U.S. through our special forces to go into towns and villages, work with tribal leaders, that, you know, Maliks or Khans, they're known as in Afghanistan, to build up their authority again in the hope that you'll have this sort of, you know, indigenous tactile structure of governance and decision making, like what they had before.
How about U.S. public opinion? And we know from national polling here that Americans are increasingly concerned about the war in Afghanistan, especially the president's Democratic base tends to be opposed to the war in Afghanistan and expanding it. To what degree, Karen, does that affect, do you think, what President Obama will decide to do?
I think it's has an extraordinary impact. Most of the Americans that I talk to who don't really follow this very carefully aren't even sure what we're doing there anymore. And that really is the question, is why are we there? The polls have been getting or growing increasingly negative about it. And now the majority of Americans aren't supporting the war anymore.
You know, we've gotten a series of emails with people raising just that very question. Bill in Little Rock sends us an email. You're only discussing half of the issue, he writes. How do we win? You're ignoring the question of why we're in Afghanistan. And the usual answer to this question, that we must be there to prevent terrorist attacks on the U.S., is only an assertion, not an argument. It's a slogan like the dominoes will fall in the days of Vietnam. Richard, what would you say to Bill?
I think there's three main reasons why we're in Afghanistan now. First is, as the president has stressed, we have a strong national interest in not seeing the return of Afghanistan to its former status as a sanctuary for terrorists with global reach that could plan attacks against the United States and our allies. But beyond that, Pakistan is in many ways even the bigger prize here. And as if anyone who reads the newspapers can tell, the Pakistani government has taken on the Taliban and insurgents at home. If we abandon all or parts of Afghanistan to the Taliban or insurgents, that could then reverse the situation we face now with insurgents in Pakistan that can come across the border in Afghanistan. If that becomes a safe haven for insurgents trying to topple the government of Pakistan, that's a truly awful scenario for the United States. And then I think third, the abandonment of Afghanistan would be a shot in the arm to the global jihadist movement that would be able to claim the defeat of arguably a second superpower in this part of the world. And we've seen in the past, after perceived successes on the parts of these jihadist groups, a serious increase in the financing and recruits that flow into these groups. And so I think, you know, for those three reasons, they really cut to the core of some of our national security interests.
To what degree are we in Afghanistan because we're in Afghanistan? Therefore, I mean, the decision to go into Afghanistan 8 years ago means that whatever the merits then, we don't have the option now of deciding, oh, never mind.
I think there's some truth to that. That's why you really need to be careful about committing military force overseas. The stay the course arguments become more and more important. In this case, I think Richard summarized the specific and practical reasons why it's in the U.S. interest to stay there a while longer until we decide this is absolutely undoable. To me, number one on the list would be Pakistan. At a time when Pakistan, at our urging, is conducting a pretty aggressive offensive against the Taliban within its own territory and suffering as a consequence terrorist bombings almost every day in its cities. I mean, you know, they're up in many hundreds of Pakistanis killed in this war that we encourage them to fight. The idea that we would at the same time walk away from the fight across the border against the Taliban, I think would have very destabilizing effects. I think the Pakistanis would feel betrayed, really, and our credibility, I hate to use that word because it's such a Vietnam word, but our credibility with the Pakistanis certainly would plummet.
Darren.
Yeah, just to also reinforce a point that Richard made about the global jihadist movement. Actually, the appeal of global jihad is in decline right now. And so if we were to walk away and you know, if we were really to help reverse that momentum, that would be a shot in the arm for global jihadists.
All right.
I might just add one point about Pakistan, I think what David said is exactly right, but it's not just about the sort of credibility and the psychological effect that would have on the leadership of Pakistan. It even goes beyond that. Every time anyone from the United States goes to Pakistan, talks about Afghanistan or the region, the first thing you hear is, we were abandoned. We were abandoned when you left this region when you stopped funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan the first time around. And there's a strong argument that this is one of the reasons why Pakistan has continued relationships, first with the Taliban when they were in power, but since then with various groups as a hedging strategy to maintain power in Afghanistan if the United States is going to pull back. So to the degree to which we further that fear, I think we further the tendency for the PACs to do just that.
Well, let's talk to Nelson. He's been holding on from Pembroke Pines, Florida. Nelson, thanks for holding.
Hello. Good morning. How's everyone?
Good. Thank you.
I just want to point out that I served in the Marine Corps and am a Vietnam veteran. When I was in Vietnam, I was in the field. That is to say that I was a grunt or an infantryman. At the time that I was in Vietnam, for every grunt that was in the field, there were five support personnel. So if you take that ratio into consideration, plus the increase of technology since Vietnam, the ratio of grunts or infantrymen in the field actually doing the fighting and the security aspect of the war is probably not going to be more than about 10 or 12,000 troops when you take the total amount of 68,000 troops in Afghanistan. And I think that's something that needs to be figured into. Adding 40,000 more troops will help booster the amount of grunts is actually in the field, those that are actually involved in the fighting and the security aspects of that particular endeavor. And I just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Oh, Nelson, before you go, we were talking about whether there are parallels to the American experience in Vietnam that seem to apply. What do you, as a Vietnam vet, what do you think about that?
Well, I think if we were to pull out of Afghanistan, as I am increasingly hearing, that would have in the long term a negative effect, pretty much as pulling out of Vietnam had a negative effect for such a long time. We have to remember it took about 20 years for the United States to come around, so to speak, and start doing those kinds of things that were necessary after the Vietnam War. We essentially abandoned that particular country because it was very difficult. I hope we don't make that mistake in Afghanistan. We are there. We're there for a good reason. The comments made by President Obama earlier that was a war that we had to win is something that I completely agree with. And to pull out because it's not easy would be a mistake.
All right, Nelson, thanks very much for your call. You know, Richard, you had mentioned the idea of number of troops and proportion to the population. What do you think about the point that Nelson was making on the use of those troops?
Well, certainly, if you increase the number of troops by, say, 40,000, not all of those are going to be in the field. There are going to be some component of those are what they refer to as enablers that are doing things either intelligence-related or logistics-related or something like that. One of the things that General McChrystal has tried to start putting into place, and I think Karen mentioned this earlier, is a move to shift about 10,000 of the troops that are already in Afghanistan into sort of trigger-puller roles and away from roles that might otherwise be filled by contractors or Afghans in some other fashion to try to maximize the amount of combat power that he can bring to bear.
All right, let's go to Alex calling us from Fort Worth, Texas. Alex, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like first to thank Diane, even though she's not there, for the great show. And I have a question. When I look at these elections in Afghanistan, they don't look any different to me from recent elections in Iran or 2000 elections in Yugoslavia when the guy in power rigs the election to the extent that he stays in power. Yet President Obama calls him and congratulates him. In your mind, does this undermine the credibility of American foreign policy?
Alex, what would you have liked President Obama to do instead? Do you think you should not have called him, or what is your...
Well, I cannot, I'm not in the position of the President of the United States of America, but, when in 2008 2 years ago, President Musharraf in Pakistan won the election pretty much through the same process. The United States stepped up and forced him to resign. When the same happened in Georgia or Ukraine or Yugoslavia, United States helped via, you know, the Rose Revolution, the Velvet Revolution, and helped to oust those people. Yet in Afghanistan, we had an election which pretty much boiled down to one candidate canceling the runoff, and yet there's such a different position of the United States.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call, Alex. Karen?
I guess the only comment I make to Alex is that, you know, Afghanistan is a sovereign state. We don't control it. We didn't control what happened in Georgia or Ukraine. These were national movements. They may have had some support behind the scenes by the United States, but they were certainly, the populations were protesting. And I think Obama really is taking a practical approach. You work with you know, who you have. You don't ask for the ideal because you just don't have it right now.
You know, Ambassador Holbrooke was named as the special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. We've heard less from him lately than at the beginning. How do you think he's doing, Richard?
Well, I did think it was interesting that it was Senator John Kerry who did most of the diplomacy with President Karzai to bring him around to the runoff accept the runoff that didn't happen. I know only what I read from some of the reports that suggest a rather testy relationship between Ambassador Holbrooke and President Karzai, given that President Karzai is going to be in place for the next 5 years. I would hope that if that is the case, then they can sort of work through that, because I think it's in all of our interests that the presidential envoy or the special envoy be on working terms with the head of the government there.
David, why do you think Senator Kerry was the one who took the lead on that?
I think in the beginning it was really an accident. Senator Kerry was going to Kabul on a fact-finding mission to try to come up with his own recommendation for the president on increase of military force. He happened to be there at a time when this issue was coming to a head. Ambassador Carl Eikenberry in Kabul took him by to see the president, Karzai, and they began talking. And talking with Senator Kerry, he describes a process that just went on and on. I think they had some 20 hours of meetings. Kept going back to the presidential palace again and again. For whatever reason, maybe the fact that he himself is a defeated presidential candidate, he knows what it's like to be on the other side, they seem to have formed a personal relationship that worked to get Karzai on board. Kerry, I think, feels great satisfaction that he accomplished that. You know, whether he's going to be getting a lot of frequent flyer miles now going back and forth to talk to his new friend Hamid, I don't know.
What do you think has happened with Richard Holbrooke, who, of course, has racked up some big diplomatic successes in the past, but is a pretty aggressive guy?
The bulldozer is his nickname, and for good reason. And in this case, in a sense, he started off with a liability, self-inflicted. He had clashed with Karzai before he was ever named to this position. And Richard Holbrooke is not somebody who really has the light touch, to put it mildly. And I think that never really got past that. Karzai dug in his heels. I think to some extent Holbrooke really has had to share this podium with a lot of other people. And if I know Holbrooke, we have not heard the last from our AFPAC coordinator.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You know, we've gotten a lot of emails about what is our goal in Afghanistan. I guess it goes back to that discussion we had earlier about should we have a counterinsurgency strategy or counterterrorism strategy. I guess the mix depends on what it is you're trying to do. Neil in Ohio has sent us an email that says, quote, "How can one determine what it would take to succeed in Afghanistan before the mission is defined? Was not the mission to be determined in part by the outcome of the Afghan election? If so, does not that outcome require a redefinition of the mission and by extension a redefinition of success? Should this election, Karen, have that kind of effect of prompting us to assess what it is exactly we're trying to do there?"
Well, unfortunately, I don't think the election is going to impact it enough. I mean, I think Obama was coming up with a strategy irrespective of what happens in the election. And most people were anticipating that there would be fraud, that Karzai would win with that fraud. I think our goals really need to be pretty simple: basic security, basic services, and justice. And, you know, empowering the Afghan National Security Forces, the army, and the police to protect their own population. And that really will let us know when we can go home.
You know, President Obama has now been in office, was elected a year ago. Election day today, it was a year ago today that he was elected president. When his first term is up, his first, maybe his only, maybe his first term is up in 3 years, Will there still be a significant number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, do you think? Let's just go around the table. Richard, what do you think?
Yes.
David, how about you?
Yes.
And Karen?
Yes.
And so that's an item of some must be of some concern both to the president and to Americans who are listening to this. Has he been trying to struggle, David, with this idea of what is our mission? What is our goal?
I think that that is deeply vexing the White House. We should be clear. We've talked sometimes on the show about the U.S. pulling out, and President Obama has made clear that he's not going to walk away from Afghanistan. We shouldn't imply that that's on the table because the president's taken it off. The question is, if we're going to stay, what's the mission we can be successful at? And that's what this discussion is really about. What is that mission? How many people will that take? And then let's get on with that one. But walking away really isn't a possibility.
I want to thank all three of you for this very interesting discussion this hour. David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Richard Fontaine of the Center for a New American Security, and Karen von Hippel of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much for joining us on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.